Connor, we live in a super fast-paced industry. There's so much new information every day.
I mean, you're not just talking about the 18,500 unread emails in my inbox, but we're talking about the data that's being generated and the new science. And sometimes there's so much overwhelming information, we just don't know how to sort like the golden nuggets from the chaff.
Exactly. Thank you for saying it nicely and politely. We're going to talk about big data and growing families and how those might be connected. We're going to start with genomic data, how computational biology can help us sift through petabytes of information to find what is useful in building databases or building families.
Oh, that sounds like an odd pairing, but I'm very interested because on one of the genealogy sites, my mother's family is one of the top largest family trees. So let's find out more about big data and big families because that's what matters on Discovery Matters.
My name is Dr. Artem Babian. I'm a Banting Research Fellow at the University of Cambridge, and I am a computational virologist.
Artem and his colleague Jeff Taylor started uncovering 100,000 novel viruses in old genetic data that could help us predict future pandemics, including 9 coronaviruses.
I mean, for me, this must be the equivalent of, you know, when you remodel a house and you peel back wallpaper, and there are layers and layers of old wallpaper. Anyway, so we read about this on science.org. The link to their study is in the show notes, but you can listen to how this project came about with us now. Connor, I think you're really going to love this.
It was purely a volunteer team that did this. COVID happened, and we were just a bunch of scientists. We didn't really know what to do. I was between work. And so we decided, okay, like, it's our job as scientists to give back and try to fight this pandemic in any way we can. And so just kind of by luck, I ended up assembling this kind of dream team of bioinformaticians, literally the best and smartest people that, you know, I'd read their papers, I'd known all about them, and I shot them an email, said, like, I'm going to try this ridiculous project. Do you want to help? Or, like, often I'd be like, I have a question about your software. And they would, you know, once they got the idea, they were like, how about instead of just answering your question, how about I come on and I'll help? It was literally like the big guns came out, and then we went from like a really good idea with a decent implementation to just everything became so optimized by the people who like developed the software to begin with. And so in that way, you know, we brought together this team, and, you know, no one was paid to do this. We didn't have any grants to do this. We just got a donation of like computing from Amazon via UBC. So we always have this goal that like we're creating a public domain resource where no one came into this with like an idea, oh, we're going to make a bunch of money or anything like that, or we're going to commercialize it. It was like we're trying to help it was like a war effort, right? A lot of scientists switched their labs to COVID. It was like, this is a huge societal problem. It's a war effort to try to fight this thing. And this was our part.
This is absolutely brilliant. I do love this. It's really poignant because we've seen so many COVID variants come out of one virus.
And you've had all of them.
I've had them all. Yeah. And the resilience of viruses and, well, humans as well, and the scientists at Cytiva, they've said that there's no better life form than a virus. They're just so good at perpetuating themselves, right?
It's not so much, I think, that the viruses are smart. Is we are fighting evolution, and that is going to always be a losing battle. You have to kind of be humble and appreciate that this, you know, this process of evolution has been going on for billions of years, and it's gotten really, really good. And viruses are kind of the most advanced and most rapidly evolving, these RNA viruses specifically, kind of organisms. So they are the hardest to kind of stamp out because they're constantly going to be changing. And so we need to figure out ways where we can kind of adapt with change.
So the search for these variants and novel viruses, there's got to be a lot of work.
And that is why Artem used computational biology.
The way I like to kind of frame this is we did about 2,000 years of computing in around 11 days. It took the world 13 years. It's between $3.9 to $14.9 billion worth of sequencing data that was generated over 13 years. This covers our entire planet's laboratory samples, environmental samples in the forest. There's even anal swabs of penguins in Antarctica. All of that data gets centralized and is freely available for all of us scientists to use and reuse. And then we said, okay, we're going to look for coronaviruses and we're going to analyze everything. And then we built this big computer. It was able to analyze the data super, super fast. And then that's why we could go from 15,000 known viruses in 2020 to 1 year later, we found over 130,000 new species.
That's a lot of viruses. And I guess the issue is really that constant transformation makes it very hard to predict what the variants are and what the relevant treatments could be.
Completely. It's similar with antibiotic resistance in bacteria. We have this beautiful technology and its misuse and misapplication. All of a sudden, we're on the other side of this battle with evolution again.
This is an arms race that our immune systems have been fighting for millions of years. And so our technology has only been fighting it for like a few decades, really.
You know, despite this revelation of novel viruses, we've probably only sampled about 0.1% of the Earth's virome.
Virome, I love that. We're not even scratching the surface. So much work to do.
Yeah, because we're vastly undersampling what the viral diversity is in nature. We're not even close to sampling the Earth virome. This is a huge problem, much bigger than what we are able to do.
The database itself is growing exponentially, which means that every 18 months, the amount of data that's being released and shared in the global community is double. So by 2023, there will be double the amount of data than what we analyzed in 2021.
In the data he's already analyzed, Artem acknowledges that they've only found familiar stuff, the viruses that look like the ones we already know of. I think this is fascinating, right? It's when you have a red car, you see so many more red cars.
And what we maybe haven't seen are like buses, and that kind of worries me a little bit. Like there's a whole bunch of viral things going on out there that we've not even seen. But then are we making an assumption that we actually have a good understanding of the number of viruses out there? It can't be true, right?
I think we're coming around to like, we don't know what we don't know. We know what we know. We don't know what we don't know. It is.
So there's a lot of unknown knowns and no.
That is exactly the issue.
It's like dark matter. It's like there's so much out there. There's the missing viral load. Where is it?
So you do the math, and we're on track to characterize over 100 million RNA viruses by 2030. This is what hyper-exponential growth looks like. It was 15,000 in 2020, 145,000 in 2021, and then 2030, you know, I want to hit 100 million. And that might actually make a real dent in Earth's virome. But at the moment, we are both sensitivity scarce and data scarce.
This is just a vast trove of genomic data that could help us find treatments, predict pandemics, understand rare diseases. But how are we wading through all of that?
That is why Artem is effectively beginning to create a search engine for these viruses.
That's what we're also developing. It's a way of functionalizing the data very quickly and efficiently. So I have kind of like a proof of concept now where you can take an RNA virus, say it's a virus that shows up in the serum of a child in Cambridge Hospital. It would take 2 minutes and cost less than 2 cents to connect that virus to a virus that was sampled in a camel in sub-Saharan Africa in 2007.
The idea is not only to create a catalog of the data, but also doing it in such a way that makes it easy to interconnect the information. So to try to make sense of all that known, unknown, and unknown known.
So all this metadata that can be pulled out from the samples collected by the global community, what they aggregate it and then functionalize it in a way that helps clinicians and researchers, right?
And then this is not just for humans. This should apply also to our animals, so livestock, pets, keeping them healthy, keeping our food sources secure, and that'll also go into agriculture. So this is going to be a problem that affects many domains of human society, and we're trying to create a general tool that can apply to all of these main domains. And endangered species, that's the other one. You know, we want to know if there's an endangered species and it has like a rare infection that's keeping its numbers down, let that be diagnosed very quickly and help conserve those species.
I think this is such an amazing discovery. I think it highlights the potential of computational biology in all of its data-driven glory. So for me, it illustrates that scientific adage that the more you know, the more you realize you don't know.
So true. Artem and his colleagues seem to have begun an encyclopedia of viruses that is just going to grow and grow and grow. It's like Wikivirus, right? Think about all the undiscovered data in the virome we're yet to exploit.
Yeah, it is an exciting thought. For example, understanding genomic data using computational biology has led researchers to begin to understand how to predict the likelihood of infertility in certain women. So here's that connection now between big data and building families. Connor, imagine that you're in hospital.
Why have you put me here?
We've put you here so that we can talk about the notes on the clipboard at the end of your bed.
The ones that say, you know, all my vital statistics, blood pressure, blood type, normal for Norfolk, and so on.
What if your notes could also detail your specific genome? And this would help doctors know if you're predisposed to a certain illness or genetic disorder.
Oh, now that is an interesting thought. I mean, we've talked about the human genome before on Discovery Matters, and it was an international project to chart the entire genetic makeup of the human being. It was completed in 2003. You can go into the Wellcome Library in London and you can read it in a book. It's a lot of letters. So it's still a really recent innovation in the world of biology.
Exactly. And it leads on very nicely to the genomic study we're about to dive into. We read about this one in Springer Nature. Read the summary if you like via our show notes. But we'll talk about it here with one of the authors who tells us how it all started almost 20 years ago.
My name is Jinchuan Xing. I'm an associate professor at Rutgers University in the Department of Genetics. My lab does research on genomic variation. So we focus on the part of the genome that's different among each of us that would make each of us special.
Professor Xing was so taken by the new area of discovery that he chose to do his PhD on the human genome.
My advisor at that time told me, you have to go watch this. It's a big deal. And so the human genome is being released. And then it's like, okay, we get the whole genome sequence, 3 billion base pair also, and we know less than a fraction of what they do. The vast majority of the genome, 99% plus, we have no clue what they do, even the made up human. And everything we're going to learn there is going to be new. And that became a very different mindset other than generating a hypothesis and doing experiments to test it. It became an exploratory discovery mission, right? To say, what can you learn from this vast unknown? And still doing it and still fascinated every day by the discovery aspect of it.
So is this one of those like huge landmark discoveries in the life sciences, like penicillin? The Human Genome Project is one of those moments, right?
Absolutely. And what's amazing is that the human genome offers something new to look for every day. There are still so many unknowns.
And so what was the focus of Jin's study?
It focused on infertility from aneuploid egg production. Now, I had to look it up, so I'm going to share it here. Aneuploidy is when there is one or more chromosomes missing. The usual number is 23, and it presents complications to have either too few or too many chromosomes.
So the overall goal of this study is trying to understand the risk of egg aneuploidy in female IVF patients. So aneuploidy is the abnormal number of chromosomes in eggs or oocytes in mom. And we are trying to both understand what are the genetic risks of this phenotype. I wouldn't even call it a disorder, right? It's really a phenotype. Also, ultimately, how can we use what we learned and apply it to clinic to help patients?
The very first line in Professor Xing's paper cites a startling statistic. 12% of women of reproductive age in the U.S. suffer infertility. That's equivalent to about 20 million individuals.
That really brings it home. I mean, it's almost 1 in 10, right? So biology is just making an incredibly important contribution here if we can get something right. And that's just the US. So globally, the number is going to be much higher.
So there is a statistic for infertility, but there's also a statistic for difficulty in getting pregnant. There's even a larger proportion of people that's affected by that. So these are reproductive age patients or women or couple, and they eventually can have healthy kids, but it took them a lot of more effort than the typical people, right? So it may take them over a year, or it may take them to go to the IVF clinic and to get to having a healthy pregnancy and live birth. And that statistic, if you count all those people together, is really close to 1 in 4 people, reproductive age couples in US. It is a really common problem, much more common than people typically imagined.
So the better we can understand infertility, the better we can help people. And to go through all the information in the human genome to understand and kind of predict the likelihood of aneuploid egg production and miscarriages, well, that's really ambitious. How did he sort through the genomes?
And this is the connection to the interview a few minutes ago. So besides whole exome sequencing, they're using machine learning, the data, okay. Manipulating the data.
Okay. So let's start with the whole exome sequencing, understanding the mutations in the genome that give way to this risk.
It's differences in chromosomes, right?
Exactly. So you can't sequence the whole genome with all of its 3 billion base pairs. You've got to find that tiny fraction of the genome that produces this phenotype, this expression in the individual.
There's only a tiny fraction of genome is coded for proteins, the components to build their body. That is about 1%. Most of the genome are not coding for proteins. And the vast majority of severe mutations are in this coding region. So whole exome sequencing is kind of a balance between the cost and effect, because whole exome sequencing is only sequencing the coding part of the genome. But in the meantime, we'll capture mutations in most of the coding region that are likely to have a functional impact.
Essentially, this helps find that specific phenotype that causes aneuploidy, which is that difference in chromosomes. And the machine learning helps to indicate those that are most likely to have this mutation.
But the issue there is most of the mutation we identified are very rare in the population. So you don't see the mutation in many people. You cannot use that mutation as a clinical test, because for most people you test, the mutation will not be there. So it doesn't help you to predict who have the risk. And so the way we do that is we use a machine learning algorithm. The goal is to look at the whole exome, all the mutations in all the coding regions in all these patients, and ask the question, if we know a group of patients, their exome looks this way, have this profile of mutations, and compared to a group of patients that have low risk, can we distinguish the two groups based on all the mutations in the genome rather than a single mutation in a single gene? That's where the machine learning really helps, because it's not a yes and no answer, right? It's a combination of mutations in different genes across the genome or the exome. And then it will predict if a person will have high risk or low risk based on what the algorithm knows from the data set we have.
So machine learning is becoming increasingly prominent in studies like this, obviously for a good reason.
Definitely. So what we've got here is just one study, but one of the larger implications would be being able to predict if an IVF treatment, right, so in vitro fertilization, if that could be successful or not. So the family planning journey could benefit from this kind of big data manipulation and insight.
It could, and we should look further than this study alone, because there are kind of interesting implications with respect to what kind of things do you want to see and what kind of things are best left alone with respect to predicting risk, right? But so what the future goal is that we use this for benefit, for the good, especially considering the really emotional topic of fertility.
That's right.
The IVF procedure is very expensive and is very have a very strong mental burden on the, especially the woman, but the couple in general, right? And for some of these patients we looked at, because the patient have such a high aneuploidy risk, the patient end up having to go through multiple IVF cycles without generating a viable embryo. And that's just putting so much stress and burden on the patient. So, you know, the ultimate goal of this is if you can predict that, say, the patient will have a much higher risk than you would predict based on the age and other risk factor, either they will have to try to retrieve more oocytes in the procedure, right? That's one way you can increase odds of getting a normal one. Or maybe a couple should think about the alternative approach, either adaptation or getting a donor egg, for example, because if you can say, you know, the chance of getting a healthy baby or pregnancy is so slim based on your genome, your risk, the alternative approach might help. Even just knowing that, I think will help patients in their mental stress.
So we're working towards real precision medicine here.
For OBGYN in the future, based on the mom's genome, predict the risk, we can provide a prognosis before the treatment. For example, if somebody are predicted to have high risk even at a younger age, they might advise the patient to either have IVF early or be prepared to have multiple cycles of IVF. There are things you can do depending on the predicted successful rate for the procedure. And I think that will be really helpful to individual patients if we can achieve that goal.
And to begin to move towards precision medicine, the next step of the study is to include more diverse genetic knowledge, because human populations are diverse. Their genetics are diverse. So the risk factor may differ in different populations. The ideal approach is to have an incredibly diverse cohort in this study so you don't miss those risk factors in different populations.
I think 10 years ago, most of the studies is focused on European ancestry, but this is not just us, right? The entire human genetics field is more and more realizing the importance of the diversity in human population and ancestry for any kind of disease, really, because the diverse ancestry of the human population gave why we are different, right? Including the disease risk.
And I can see how this contributes to the sort of the future hope of precision medicine, because we need to understand the differences across the genome for every individual. And as Jin's findings show, the ancestry does impact the genome.
Precision medicine, using genomic sequencing or other information that's unique to you to help you in the healthcare, in the medical field. I think one thing I really think is going to happen pretty soon is the whole genome sequencing will become part of the health record. We only need to sequence the genome once. Then you get your profile for your entire genome that can go into the electronic health record. All the patients will have access to it. So when someone goes into the clinic, regardless it's because of a heart disease or infertility or any kind of disease that have a genetic component, the doctor can look up the genomic profile, say if there's anything in the genome, the risk of the mutations or genes, then that can help. And I hope what we are doing will be contributing to that, especially to the IVF patients.
So in this episode, Connor, we've looked way, way back, really dug into those old layers of wallpaper in our house. And we're trying to look ahead too, about families of viruses and families in humans.
And these are just huge topics that we just can't simply do the calculations on in our brains. I
mean, yeah, this math is not bad, like, right? Memorizing the multiplication table doesn't help you here.
Yeah, and I didn't even do that. So look, computation, machine learning, the whole enterprise here is making branches of scientific examination possible that were never ever possible before. Our executive producer is Andrea Killen, and this podcast is produced with the help of Bethany Grace Armit-Brewster. Editing, mixing, music, and incredible artificial intelligence by Tom Henley and Banda Productions. My name is Connor McKechnie. I'm not an artificial intelligence.
And I am Dodie Axelson, as I live and breathe. Make sure you rate us on Spotify or whichever platform you listen to us on. If you are listening on Spotify, by the way, please answer our poll. It's under the episode description and it helps make us better. We'll see you when we come back with another episode of Discovery Matters.
Outstanding. I just need to brew a coffee now.